This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, leave a carrot by the chimney for language. Thanks to Ashra, by the way, for another year of collecting what are known in the Allusiverse as inwitches and illustrating each of them with a carefully chosen GIF. You can see all of them at inwitches.tumblr.com. I'm sure future generations will be studying it avidly for clues to the meaning of life. Today's episode is our annual lucky dip of bonus bits, which I've been saving all year because often Allusionist guests say too many interesting things to fit into one episode, or they say interesting things that aren't about language. So I stashed those things away until now. There have been lots of very fine episodes this year for you to catch up on. We've had the surprising history of Dude and Zero and other numbers and hedge witches. We heard from the inventor of the portmanteau misogynoir. We heard about language for asexuality and aromanticism, for trans parenthood, for disability and bereavement and mental health. We learned how Icelandic is handling the 21st century. We heard about cakes and recipes as forms of protest. We started the year with analysis of apologies. That episode has been very useful. In fact, if you know a celebrity, send it to them just in case, because they will probably end up needing it. On with the bonus bits of 2021. This year, you tested your food etymology knowledge in the play-along food quiz with Samin Nosrat and Hrishikesh Hirway, and we landed on a surprisingly provocative subject. Define a salad.
It's some stuff with a dressing on it.
Wow, so dressing's a critical part to you.
Yes?
I prefer my salads nude. Not all of them, not like potato salad, but generally like a... If it's just a fairly vegetably salad, then yes.
Wait, you want to... Wait,
how about
is it,
a fruit salad? There's no dressing on a fruit salad.
Yeah, of course there is. Okay, first of all, explain to me a nude... We just like glossed over Helen's nude vegetable salad, which what is just... That's like a... That's just a bowl of vegetables. That's a bowl...
Yeah. Chopped up.
That's just things. A bowl of vegetables. That's not a salad.
How is it not a salad? What is a salad? Rishi, what's a salad? It's a nightmare word to define.
Yeah. Salad.
No, I just defined it. Some stuff with some dressing on it. Of the three of us, only one of us is a chef and a restaurant person and an actual cook who's written a cookbook.
You have. It's true. But I've eaten a salad with my own mouth that's undressed. So that's the proof in the opposite direction. It can happen.
But...
Do you have criteria for what the dressing has to appear on? Because like you couldn't just pour dressing over like one whole potato and call that a salad, right? That'd be one potato with dressing on.
That would just be a dressed potato.
So where does the saladness?
Yeah, I think salad needs some element of mishmash.
Yeah, choppage.
Or just combination.
Pieces.
Pieces plus dressing equals salad.
Mm-hmm. But the pieces could be of the same, like, ilk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what, like one kind of lettuce?
Mm. Or all the same kind of tomato or all the same kind of cucumber.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Also, back to the fruit salad question, often fruit salad has a little sugar and or lemon juice, which constitutes a dressing.
Would you say that is the ideal version of a fruit salad? I mean, platonic ideal? Because that sounds like an exception to what I imagine fruit salad is, which is just the
fruits. I mean, are you talking about like a fruit cocktail from a can?
No, I'm talking about fruit salad. I'm talking about, you know, it's Sunday brunch and along with the omelet and hash browns, you get some fruit salad and it's just, you know, blackberries, raspberries, some honeydew that nobody wants, and some sad grapes.
Like a whole bunch of dry fruit in a bowl.
Not dried fruit. Fresh fruit.
No, not dried. Dry.
Yeah,
as in nude, dry. Nude fruit.
Nude fruit.
But there's no dressing.
Yeah, that's a sad situation. That's to me like cut up fruit in a bowl.
Samina's a never nude for salads.
Correct.
Seriously, salad is difficult to define. You try it. Any definition you can come up with, there will be a salad to contradict it. Also perplexing are ladybirds, or ladybugs, you might call them. Neither ladies, nor birds, nor bugs. They are, however, very interesting and ingenious creatures. Here is Tamsin Majerus, aka Dr. Ladybird, to talk about some of their many powers.
Most ladybirds, you're probably aware of, have spots. So that's, you know, if you asked anybody, they'd say, oh yeah, the ladybirds have spots. There are ladybirds that have stripes. And there is originally named striped ladybird, which has whitish stripes on an orange, a pale orange background. And they are warningly coloured when they sit on the pine trees, which is where they live. So they stand out against the pine needles very clearly. They're very obvious, and that will scare off the predators. But they can also blend in with the pine buds. So if they nestle in with the pine buds, they're beautifully camouflaged and they sit head in to the pine buds. So the shape is right as well. You get the end of their abdomen sticking out where the pine buds are pointing out. So they do a kind of double thing. And there's another species that does something similar. The water ladybird has two very distinct patterns at different times of the year. So in the summer, when they're active, they are bright pink with brownish spots. And in the winter, all the reeds that they would normally live on, which normally in the summer are green, the reeds go brown and they maybe have a little bit of mold or something on them. So they have some black dots and the ladybirds become brown with black spots. And so they blend in. And so they Incredible. Can be camouflaged during the winter when they're not so active and mobile and they don't want anyone to bother them.
How'd they switch that on?
Just very clever. One of the things we don't know, although we're beginning to learn, is how they switch the colours on and off. There's clear, quite simple genetic control on many of the things. So we can look at inheritance of the colours and we can see, you know, if you cross two spots that are both red with black spots, you'll get red with black spots offspring, more or less.
I suppose some of us might be surprised to hear that a lot of it is for camouflage, considering ladybirds are such a distinctive looking insect when we do see them. Mm. So they do stand out quite conspicuously in some contexts.
Yes, you know, there's also obviously recognition, mate recognition. Some of that is done with pheromones, so things you can't see, but you can smell. But other things that there seem to be particular mating preferences for different. So where you have a species like the two spot has the common form that everybody would recognize with two black spots on a red background. It also has a kind of reverse form where you have red spots on a black background. And it seems that some of the female ladybirds will prefer to mate with males that have that black, the melanic, as we call it, colour pattern. Mm. And that seems to be genetically controlled, seems to be a single gene that controls it. So the colour patterns can be very important in that mate recognition as well.
I don't want to seem like too much of a ladybird sex pervert, but could say a two-spot ladybird mate with one of the ones that is yellow with lots of spots?
They will primarily only mate with their own species,
yeah.
But that within a species, that all the variants will mate with each other. You do get matings between different species, particularly if they're closely related. So two spots and 10 spots, which are two of our British species, they're different species, but they're the same genus, but they will mate with each other and they'll produce offspring, but the offspring are sterile. So they can make viable offspring, but then those offspring can't go on to make more. That's just about genetic differences that mean that it'll kind of work once, but then it can't deal with another generation of trying to do the same thing.
There are several versions of the nursery rhyme that begins, "Ladybird, ladybird, fly away home." The next line usually involves something horrific happening to the ladybird's children. After all the help they provide in agriculture, why do ladybirds have such a bad time in poetry?
Maybe that came from the people who used to go travel from London to Kent to help with crop farming, crop gathering at the end of the season. And they would say it to the ladybirds because obviously when they cut all the crops, they would then, when they'd harvested the crops, they'd burn the stubble. And so the reference to fire is about the farmers burning, which would obviously kill the ladybirds and destroy their homes. And so they needed to get away quickly.
Where could they go? Where could they go in Kent?
Well, I don't know. It's difficult, isn't it? Into the shrubbery. They'll be fine.
Right, yeah. Just go for the ornamental plants.
Yeah, the other rhymes are sort of more romantic. So again, maybe feeding back into this sort of fertility theme that you know, the ladybird flies away towards your true love in some way. And so they call upon the ladybird to fly to their sweetheart. And the word ladybird, obviously, Romeo and Juliet, there's a little quote from Romeo and Juliet.
What ladybird, what Juliet.
What love, what ladybird, yeah, what Juliet, exactly. So again, I guess it means sweetheart in that context.
Not so romantic, although still very evocative, is a ladybird ability known as male killing. What's that? Well, it's exactly what it sounds like.
Male killing is caused by bacteria that live in the female ladybird, and they get into her ovaries and into the eggs that she produces. And somehow, and we don't really know how, they kill off the embryos that are destined to become male. So when she lays her clutch of eggs, normally we expect half of those will end up being female ladybirds, the other half will be male ladybirds. But a female ladybird that has a male killer will often have a clutch of eggs where only about half of them hatch. And the half that hatch go on to become female. So the males were killed right at the very beginning of their lifetime. And it works, surprisingly, because the female larvae in something which is slightly disgusting, as they emerge from the egg, they need to eat something very quickly or they'll starve to death. They've got male eggs right there that aren't hatching into larvae. They eat those eggs, so they eat their dead brothers. Nasty little bit of cannibalism. But
it's pragmatic cannibalism.
Yeah, exactly. They're off to a big advantage compared to females in a clutch where everything hatched and there wasn't anything to eat. So
I'm sure this is a metaphor for something. Thorbjörg Þorvaldsdóttir came on The Illusionist to talk about the Icelandic language's moves to include more queer and gender-free vocabulary, and how that is challenging because the whole language is grammatically gendered. Can you have a gender-free grandparent?
We could say... No, we don't. We don't. We need one. We have Amma for grandmother and Avi, and we just have Ammo Avi. I don't even think we have grandparents. Now I'm suddenly like, am I wrong? But I don't think we do. We would just have to say Ammo Avi.
What we don't have in English is a gender-free word for aunt or uncle. So we do have grandparents and parents and siblings, but not that.
Yeah, we don't have that either. So we have Franka for a female relative, and then, or female, a bit more distant relative than the closest family. And then we have the frendi, the male, more distant relative. We've been trying to, and that's another word we need for non-binary people. So we need a third term there as well. Some people have been using Frank, where they take the feminine term and take the ending away.
It's nice.
Yeah. So that's one way of doing it. But we don't have the distinction between aunt and uncle and niece and nephew and cousin. We don't. It's all frendi or franka. This is a problem for us when we learn English. That we need to figure out all of these relationships and how people are related to each other.
No one really understands cousins.
but the word frendi, that means male distant relative, or not really distant, but cousin, uncle, so on, is related to friend.
Oh.
Yeah, or it's the same word, basically. So that's cute.
Nice.
Yeah.
Paul Tyerman of PK Porthcurno, the Museum of Global Communications, came onto the show to talk about SOS, the breakout star of Morse code. Why do you think Morse code became prevalent?
It's probably simplicity, really. It's such a simple thing to use and learn that it became the standard way of doing it. Morse code became prevalent before radio, when the telegraph was still on wires. Over at PK, we have loads of systems that people developed in the early days of the telegraph to read the signals at the other end. As things got further and further away, you needed much more sensitive instruments to detect things. So you ended up with a very sensitive galvanometer, which measures tiny, tiny electrical currents, and it would go one way or the other. Because these old ones moved so slowly, the cable code became, it was exactly Morse code, except that instead of dot and dash, it went left and right. That led to all kinds of useful things. So you could get automation. So you would send it to a kind of a siphon recorder. So a paper strip would be pulled through this machine, and a little siphon in a pot of ink would be put down on the page. And as it moved left and right, then the trace on the piece of paper moved left and right. And experienced operators could read that, but it gave a permanent record of the signal that had gone.
There have also been similar systems involving holes being punched into paper strips.
So the paper would be pulled through the machine and it would punch holes left and right for the dashes and the dots of the Morse code. That could be automated then. So somebody could type just on a typewriter keyboard. That would punch the correct holes for the letters. And then the tape would go through a machine, which would send the Morse code faster than somebody could tap it out. And then at the other end, another machine could punch a new tape for somebody to read there.
During the second half of the 19th and early 20th centuries, cables were laid under the sea to create a worldwide telegraphy network, allowing words to travel between continents in the same day. But over the really long stretches of cable, the signal would get very weak, so you couldn't send a signal over a long distance in one go, for instance, from Australia to Britain. Therefore, tiny islands in the middle of oceans suddenly became very useful to telegraphy companies, so they could plonk relay stations on them.
There were all kinds of stations at places like Ascension Island. And so you'd have people there who would read the message coming in, write it down, and then send it out again. And by the 1920s, with this punched paper tape, they'd invented a system called Regen, which regenerated the signal without any human intervention. It's all based on clockwork, clocks for timing, electromechanical switches and motors to keep everything running, and completely automatic. So the staff on those little cable stations then got a lot smaller. Just needed someone to keep everything running and no one to write the messages down and send them again. So one story we tell the children that come out to PK is that life on those stations changed because instead of playing football and cricket with a team of people, you'd be playing tennis with your whole staff because there weren't enough there for team sports.
Yeah, or just hitting a ball against a wall on your own.
Yeah.
It is amazing, though. I mean, it still seems extremely impressive.
It is. I mean, we've still got a similar kind of thing, even with fibre optics, because even the light signal gets weakened on the way through the cables, through the fibres. So underneath the ocean, there are things about the size of a cow which boost the light signal, get it bright enough for the next stage of the cable.
And now I have a mental image of cows strolling around on the ocean floor, beaming light around. Not complaining, it's nice. Finally, talking about a different kind of signal is Maddie Lang of BA Concierge in Buenos Aires, who appeared before to tell us about the cake names of Argentina, which arose from protest in 1888 and are still in use today. Here she talks about another form of protest, cacerolazo, which involves banging your pots and pans. Cacerolazo has been used a lot in South American countries, but also across the world. In fact, this very year, people in Myanmar protested the military coup with cacerolazo at 8 p.m.
When the protests here started, they actually began, everything kind of does revolve around food. It began with, I believe, the conventillos. These were like these big old mansions that once the rich people moved north to the greener pastures, all the immigrants started, you know, moved into these big, big mansions. So instead of a single family home, it would be like a 100 family home. And there was maybe one bathroom and the rent was really high. And so these conditions were really bad. And it was actually the grandmas and the moms that would grab their pots and pans and bang. And that's how the protest began. And they call it cacerolazo, basically like the big casserole do. And to this day, every once in a while, the city or the, you know, the social networks will plan a cacerolazo, or just, you know, before social media, was just the neighbors or the newspapers. And if you're, if you really care about whatever you're protesting against, which is usually the government, you can go to a big street corner and everybody knows the main corners of the city where they do this. Or you just go out on your balcony at 9 p.m. on whatever day and you bang your pots and pans. And it's, for me, like, I love it. It's because it's just this real thing that happens without computers, without telephones. But it's the pots and pans because these are these like basic things that you have that, to make noise.
Like with the cake names, you make your point with whatever resources you've got. The Illusionist is an independent podcast, and I love to be in league with other independent podcasts, independenting together. And in the Podlingual episode this year, I was joined by two independent podcasters, James Kim and Laurie Martinez, who were talking about making multilingual podcasts. So I thought I'd tell you about Laurie's company, Studio Ochenta's new show called Caper. It's a true crime show about some of the most famous heists in history, like the theft of the Mona Lisa or of Edvard Munch's Scream. The show is available in English, Spanish, German, and Italian. So go and get Caper for free from the pod places or at acentastudio.com. It has been a very different year for The Illusionist this year, and huge thanks to you for listening and telling people about the show and supporting emotionally and financially at patreon.com/illusionist. The podcast will return with new episodes in February 2022, but in January, patrons will be getting live streams. Oh yes, I'd better tidy up my flat, or put up a backdrop of a tidy person's flat. Join us for those and hang out with your fellow patrons at patreon.com/illusionist. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is nootropic, adjective, denoting drugs used to enhance memory or other cognitive functions. Try using nootropic in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman. The music is by Martin Austwick of palebirdmusic.com. Our ad partner is Multitude. Sponsor an episode of the show in 2022, contact them at multitude.production/ads. Thanks Amanda and Carly at Multitude for all your work for the show this year. Keep in touch, find Illusionist Show on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook, and to hear or read every episode of the show. Get links to more information about topics therein, obtain merch such as the Potato Fugue State sweatshirts, see the full dictionary entries for the randomly selected words, and browse a lexicon of every word ever covered in the show to listen to the episode about it. Visit the show's forever home, theillusionist.org.